Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 8 of Chris Chambers Noir. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and we also push out on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple. And Wildwood Exit is Joel's book, and The Bush Tea Murder is Ashley Ruth Bernier's book. So I'm going to throw it over to Chris, and he's going to talk to these fantastic folks about what it's like to be a noir writer.
Welcome and happy Friday the 13th to everybody. Hopefully nothing crazy will happen. Again, this is Chris Chambers Noir. The podcast is on our iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. You can see our bright shining faces on YouTube and the Incandescent Radio Network. So it is really a pleasure to have you guys here. We're going to get to the nitty gritty and put you on the real controversial spot about, is it noir? Isn't it noir? We're going to do that later. So we're going to come to that and really put you on the hot seat. We're just going to put you on the lukewarm seat right now just to get, so people can get to know you better. Because, you know, these are two great books, and they're, you know, are they related? Aren't they related? I mean, they kind of are. I mean, we kind of get siloed as crime fiction writers, but there's common threads, and we're going to explore that. But, you know, we've got Joel E. Turner. What does E stand for, by the way?
Edward.
Oh, that's boring. Okay. Yeah. Luckily, we have Ashley, who has a really cool long name. It just blows Joel's away here. But Joel is the author of Wildwood Exit. The charming and sweet and low key interaction of Mr. McGinty with the Skeletta clan, a very interesting group of people. Not, you know, they're not Nicky Scarfo or the Chicken Man or any of those people that Bruce Springsteen sings. And they're more of a Beverly Hillbillies sort of version of some of your favorite bent nose people in Philly and on the Jersey Shore. So we're going to get to that. Then there's Ashley Ruth M. Bernier. The Bush Tea Murders is her first novel that's coming out, dropping in another month, right?
Just over a month, 21st of April. I'm really excited.
And we're going to talk about that and your very huge body of short fiction and the interplay there. Naomi St. Clair is your protagonist, an amateur sleuth, kind of like Mr. McGinty. Yes. Or Ginty. Is he go by McGinty or Ginty? It's Ginty, right?
Ginty would be the nickname, yeah.
Okay, Ginty, yeah. And so a little more erudite than what's going on the shore, down the shore. She's a food writer and now an amateur sleuth. And her boyfriend, his name was Mateo. And that sounds suspiciously like your personal life. Is that?
Well, okay. So interestingly, so Naomi's love interest has the very unusual name of Mateo Ramkumar. And that is, in the Caribbean, we have so many mixtures. Everybody dates everybody else. So that character is half Puerto Rican and half Trini Indian, which isn't too unusual in the Caribbean. Okay. My husband is also half Puerto Rican and half French from St. Bart's. So,
Well, no, that's totally not like the character.
Totally not like all right. Real different.
Well, we're gonna try to have a good time here and you know, get into these issues. And really at the end, we're not gonna try to answer any questions, but we just showcase you guys. But show the common threads here, you know, like what, you know, is it noir? Isn't it noir? What is noir? I mean, that's why I wanted to have you guys, because you got, you know, it seems just disparate, but it really isn't. But let me go right to our, I usually do a funky icebreaker. I'm going to start with Joel here. Okay. When I was in school, in college in New Jersey, and we were driving down to the shore, there was a sign that said, welcome to Wildwood. And somebody had spray painted, if you can't get laid here, you're dead. Okay. Now, I've been to Asbury Park too, and all I saw was just regular graffiti. And I've been to Cape May, and all I've seen is, you know, come to our bed and breakfast here.
Right.
What is up with Wildwood? I mean, what is this? You know, and again, I don't think they changed this sign for a long time. The spray paint was there for a while. What is up with that place?
Well, you know, so for one thing, you mentioned Cape May, and Wildwood and Cape May are like right next to each other, but they couldn't be more different, right? I mean, Wildwood has a boardwalk and Cape May has a promenade. You know, Wildwood has doo-wop architecture. Cape May has Victorian gingerbread kind of a thing.
Explain to everybody what doo-wop architecture is, because it does kind of sound very, and we're going to get into South Philly in a minute. It sounds very Philly, very, you know, it does sound like who's the group that sang Sherry Baby and all that?
The Four Seasons. Yeah.
Four Seasons and Dion. Yeah. What is doo-wop?
You know, it really has nothing to do with doo-wop. It's more it's more the 50s era.
Right.
So if you think of, you know, sort of, if you would imagine George Jetson going to, you know, he goes to the drive-in diner and it's got the big swoop things and stuff like that. So it's very kind of a 50s futuristic, you know, kind of a thing. And sort of akin to how cars were in the 50s.
Right.
The fins and the chrome and all that kind of stuff. So that's sort of kind of what doo-wop architecture is. But, you know, Wildwood, one of the things about the Jersey Shore, at least the part from Atlantic City down to Cape May, is there's all different sections of Philadelphia that go to different places. And so, like, I actually grew up in the Philadelphia suburbs, so, you know, semi-bougie. And so we would go down to Avalon or Stone Harbor, which
is,
you know, sort of nice. And if you're a little bit poor, you might go to Sea Isle. We went there too when we were a little poor. And Wildwood is like South Philly, Northeast Philly, like the more urban parts of Philadelphia, row houses and stuff like that. And people go there. And so that's sort of, you know, the milieu, heavy South Philly population there. So Italian American. And I mean, when I worked a lot of summers at the shore, and I was usually working in Avalon. But when we wanted to go out to a bar, we would go to Wildwood and Margate, like up there, you know?
Yeah, so, it's a lot of people don't, they look at the Jersey Shore as this monolith.
No, it's not at all.
And it's not, yeah. You know, and I went from there, I could tell right off the bat. And, you know, you talked about Stone Harbor and places like that. Yeah, I mean, Stone Harbor would probably be more like, you know, the Virgin Islands where Ashley grew up.
it's like the main line. It's
right.
Like the main line that goes down there, particularly the Catholic main line.
Right. Well, so when you were growing up in Philly, I mean, did you grow up in a typical kind of, was it a detached house neighborhood? Was it a row house? I live in a row house neighborhood in D.C.
Well, I actually grew up in the suburbs. Right?
Oh, okay.
So I grew up in, you know, classic suburbs, you know, detached houses, all that kind of stuff. But I went to high school in the city, and I went to a school in North Philadelphia. So North Philadelphia is more of a black section of town,
right,
a poor section of town. But there were guys who came in. It was an all-boys school, and they came in from all over the city. So that's when I first – and there were a lot of guys from South Philly there. In fact, Sal Testa was he here behind me? He was one of the gang in Philadelphia.
Yeah,
he got killed.
I mean, I was going to ask you. I mean, are you kind of like a low key Henry Hill? Like, I mean, because you know your name is Turner, not Toretto.
Right.
So I mean, were you kind of on the fringe of these dudes or what?
No, I was a good boy. I was a good boy, but I knew a lot of guys from South Philly, and we were like a prep school, so we had sort of mostly the smarter guys, but not all.
Right.
You know? And you were like one degree of separation away from people who were very mob affiliated, because at that time in Philly in the 70s and the 80s. It was pretty heavy, but I was a good boy, but I knew a lot of people.
Well, we'll take your word for it, because
sure, there you go.
You know, it this novel is a little too to look at a one definition of noir, a little too stylized realism for you just to be floating above it. There's got to be, you got your hands dirty somewhere here, but we're gonna get back to that.
Yeah.
So Thank you for that, Joel. Let's go to Ashley. And you and I talked about this. I don't know whether you stub a toe, have menstrual cramps, or have stage 4 cancer. West Indians will burn a bush,
yes,
and boil it and make it into a tea and claim it's. I mean, what is up with that? I mean,
I don't know what it is, but it's been passed down for generations. I mean, growing up, it was the same thing. My grandmother we had a medicine cabinet, but she also had this immense garden that surrounded her whole house, right? And it was, you have a cold, go get a piece of aloe. You know, the aloe is going in your orange juice, whether you like it or not.
Right.
And that stuff was horrible, but it would knock the cold right out of your body. there's tea bush outside, Sunday mornings, you get back from church, she'd send you outside, you pick the tea, she'd boil it. It was out there. There was fruit just for the picking. Like, we didn't need a snack from the store. There were trees all over the place in her garden. You could just pick the gooseberries right off the tree. You could pick the limes right off the tree. You could pick the mangoes right out of the tree. Like, there was always something for your aches and pains, for your growling belly, for anything. it was there in the garden.
Yeah, my dad is a Jamaican, and my great aunt had this stuff called busy tea, which I swear probably had coca leaves in it.
Oh, yeah.
I talked to a poet and author Colin Channer, wrote Waiting in Vain and a lot of those books. And he said, there probably was coca leaves in there.
I wouldn't be surprised.
You grew up in St. Thomas, right?
In St. Thomas, right. Yeah.
What, there is... There's a school of thought that we're still in icebreaker phase now, by the way, folks, get to know you. But there's a school of thought that Joel had mentioned different parts of Philly, putting on a serious cap. I mean, is there, if you wanted to switch, and we're going to play with these definitions too, from cozy to hard boiled, and just do the Virgin Islands, you probably could do that, couldn't you?
Oh,
because
yes.
there's a lot.
There is a lot. And
of stuff, yeah.
When I try to stay on the joyful side of things.
Right, right.
But there's a lot of it that's actually steeped in reality. Like, when you think about the fact that there is a corrupt senator in one of the parts of my book. Like,
right.
There's unfortunately a lot of corruption and monetary abuse going on in different parts of the government. When you think about the murder rate, unfortunately, per capita, when you have such a small place, but a murder rate that tends to per capita be higher than many places in the United States. And even when you get a little bit bigger, and I'm going to touch on this, when you think about the connection to like Jeffrey Epstein and the amount of corruption that went on in high levels of the government that allowed that sort of thing to go on. I mean, I probably could switch it up if I wanted to and get pretty serious. But I choose to stay on the joyful side.
Right. No, it just seems everybody can pivot. I mean, Joel can pivot, pivot to a cozy. You can pivot to something hard boiled. I mean, I've never, when you look at, and then we go back to the Virgin Islands. I mean, you've got the more urban crime settings on St. Thomas, but there's just as many people getting their heads knocked in down in St. Croix, which is very rural.
Yes.
I really shocked me. I was like, wow. I mean, this is crazy as Jamaica's.
Yeah, and with a smaller population. So when you think about it, when things like that happen, it feels a lot more personal. Everybody can find a connection. I know that person. He was, so-and-so's grandchild, so-and-so's brother. I went to school with his sister, whatever. There's a connection because the population is so small and connected. Those crimes tend to hit a lot harder.
Well, let me come back to you and bounce back to Joel. I mean, what was your journey before Wildwood Exit? I mean, you had short fiction, but it wasn't crime fiction specifically.
Really wasn't crime at all. I mean, the short fiction that I published, A lot of it was, I guess you call it dystopian. So sort of science fiction-y. I was a great devotee and still am of J.G. Ballard, you know, and all the stuff he did. So it was more, you know, near future, you know, dystopian kind of fiction. There was a little bit of it that God forbid, might have been considered literary, but I think it's just because it wasn't in any kind of like genre or anything. So that was sort of my journey. And I started writing fiction a long time ago. And the short fiction that I published originally, most of it was published in the UK, because I, J.G. Ballard, who he is, the author of Empire of the Sun, you know, Crash right. and all that. He was the fiction editor of a magazine called Ambit that was a very kind of avant-garde, or at least not academic, literary magazine. And they published a story of mine. And then I was traveling on business in London and got to know the guy who ran the magazine, not Ballard.
Right.
And they published a bunch of my fiction over there. And they were very encouraging. So I then moved on to writing novels. And I wrote one novel, the first novel I wrote, which actually was, you know, set in the 60s and was about fashion design and rock and roll. And it was a crazy story, but it was about 700 pages. And it was not, you know, so I was immediately told, this is too long a book to try to get published as your first novel. And then I came up with the idea for Wildwood Exit. And, you know, it wasn't like I sat down and said, oh, I'm going to write a crime novel. It was, you know, it really actually was based off of a true incident of a friend of mine actually in D.C. Wow. who bought a car, didn't have the title transferred, was in a bad accident, and just walked away. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I kind of transplanted that to the Jersey Shore. And I'd spent a lot of time down there and thought it was a good milieu to tell a, you know, gritty and yet somewhat humorous story, you know, set down there.
Yeah, I was curious because, you know, you've got I'm not going to say the tropes, but the archetypes and everything all set. I mean, even I think this guy, Davey, is like your MacGuffin, I think, that kind of sets stuff in motion. Is that's a trope or a device that we use. Right. I mean, you got a character that their only purpose is to get everybody else riled up. I mean, you seem to take into that like a duck to water.
Right.
You know, I mean, did it take any training or formal stuff? Did you look at either short stories or novels?
You know, I really didn't. I you know, probably the things that influenced me the most were one was Pete Dexter. If you know Pete Dexter, he wrote God's Pocket
right.
and Paris Brown. I like his stories because while they certainly a lot of them had a criminal element to them, they're really kind of character studies. So he was a big influence on me. And I got to admit that both The Sopranos and everything that Martin Scorsese did were big influences. It did take me a little bit of time because I did one version of it that wasn't quite there. And then I worked with a guy, John McGoran, who's a writer and editor. And he helped me kind of get a different view of the story and raise the stakes a little bit. And that was sort of how I got into it. I have a few people that I, you know, go to help me to read stuff, but most of them aren't professionals.
How do you answer people that say that these Skelet is, you know, they kind of have this Soprano-ish patina, but not quite. I mean, but they aren't. I mean, are people just trying to kind of push you into a corner, or is this a natural connection that people make? You know, it's very Soprano like. What do you say?
You know,
to that?
At least the people that I talk to, so actually people that I see at readings and stuff like that, they usually like the book.
And I'm not saying like or dislike, that doesn't really come up so much.
That hasn't really, you know, been an issue for me. I have had some kind of reviewers online who have said, this is just, you know, it's another version of the Sopranos kind of a thing. But I felt, that the characters that have their own lives, they're quite different. And so that doesn't really concern me. And it doesn't seem like I really have to, you know, be concerned about that.
When you, you know, everybody says write what you know. I mean, clearly, as I said, I mean, you pulled a lot of South Philly, you know, into this. And you know, again, one definition of noir that George Pelicanos told me is stylized realism. I mean, and you know, you definitely hit on that. But, and then we're going to get to this when we get to the nitty gritty. I mean, but there's, you know, there's the humor aspect too. And you, you know, was that natural because, you know, occurring because of the type of people you're writing about? Or did you have to really plan that and insert that?
Yeah, I would say it has to come out of the characters, right? And I mean, because there are some things that you'll read which are more like farce-like almost. So like Carl Hyacin, you know, I write like his writing a lot. But man, you know from get-go, you know, where you're kind of headed with it.
It's going to be crazy.
But to me, you know, humor has to come out of, has to be reality based. And so it has to sort of, as opposed to, you know, just like throwing a banana peel on the floor and somebody trips and, you know, that's funny. I don't know. I guess I was just lucky that actually some of the characters I came up with, particularly, you know, Pinto, who's, you know, unreconstructed hood that he gets hooked up.
Right.
With. It's just a funny character. So a lot of things that he says, you know, lead to, you know, humorous interaction.
Well, you know, it seems that, you know, you hit on all the devices. Mm-hmm. But you also managed to write, if this is fair, a very good mob story that isn't really a mob story. I mean, is that a good assessment right there?
There's sort of a level below, like the fully operational mob, you know, without giving, you know, too much of the story away. Lou's involved in some pretty shady business, but it's almost like it's a sideline for him. And Pinto is, you know, a bit of a hood, but he's not like a made man. He's not killing people. Maybe he's never killed anybody in his life. And Ginty is just, you know, he's an out of work bartender, just falls into this thing, you know. And then the you mentioned Davey, who is Lou and Lou's and Cachetta's son, and he's a drug addict. That really is the source of his problem. So it's really sort of more of a street level, you know, it could almost happen to you kind of situation, as opposed to, you know, people getting whacked and their purpose in life being like Tony Soprano, you know, every day I'm running a mob operation.
Right. People, in your type of story, when people die, it's usually because somebody's stupid, not because somebody sits in a room and gets a green light to go put a bullet in somebody's head.
Right.
Let me jump to Ashley for a minute, and I'm going to put you on the spot here. Okay.
Sure.
You have a incredible body of short fiction. I mean, that's how, I guess, you know, how can I put it? That's how you're known. You know,
the
short fiction. You've probably been asked, you know, is it a different brain you're using to do the novel? I'm going to ask you a different question. I mean, why go to a novel? Is it something you always wanted to do, or was it an agent or a publisher that said, now this is the next step? Because my next question is going to be, is it an artistic decision or is it a business decision? I mean, so, you know, what do you say to that?
So that's a great question. And the short answer is that the novel is actually, this is kind of like a hybrid. It's a novel and stories. So when I first started writing stories about Naomi Sinclair, I was walking through the grocery store and I got hit with the idea of a short story about a stolen Johnny Cake recipe. And I just knew I had to write this story because it felt connected, and it was called Rise, and it had all these different connections with the meaning, and it was going to be great. And I knew that once I wrote that story, I was going to write more about her. And so over the course of the next couple of years, I wrote there's like a total of like 11 short stories with her now. And, you know, one of them, the first one was published in Ellery Queen magazine. The second was published in Black Cat Weekly. And then that one was, went on to the Best American Mystery and Suspense, which was awesome. And with all of these stories that I wrote about her, they were standalones, but if I, you know, if you assemble them in a certain order, there was a narrative arc there. And so when I first started to submit the collection for, you know, agents or to small publishing houses, I submitted it as a short story collection. I thought of it more of as like a novel in stories where,
okay.
Yeah, these, so anyway, when my agent finally reached out to Crooked Lane, who's publishing the Bush Tea Murder. My fantastic editor there said, this is great. Like, I love the short stories. They're wonderful. But do you think that you could write an overarching story to kind of pull them all together? And it was the beginning of last summer, and I just learned that I was pregnant. And I was just like, I don't know. Can I? Because I, like, all I wanted to do was just crawl into bed and sleep. But I knew the story so well. I knew the characters so well. And it really just felt like it flowed. The overarching story was probably like the easiest part of it to put together because, and it really just pulled all of, it took some changes to some of the stories. One of them had to unfortunately get eliminated from the collection. And one of them was like changed dramatically in order to fit with the overarching story. But yeah, so it reads like a novel with six shorter stories inside of it that pull the whole thing together. Okay. So it really is just like a mix of a novel and a short story collection.
Do you think that sets it apart from a lot of the kind of food-based cozies?
I hope so. Yeah. I definitely hope so. Because short fiction, to me at least, like, is about a very a punchy, connected piece of work that really hits a theme hard and hits it well. I feel like the stories themselves are, you know, like there's a message in each one of the shorter stories. And I feel like it all gets pulled together with the overarching story. And I do feel like that kind of sets it apart. They're different foods, different crimes. And so it's not just one mystery. There are several that kind of play into it. But so I hope that sets it apart.
No, I'm just trying to think. I don't know if it was Ellery Queen or something, but you've done something fairly hard boiled though, haven't you? Or hard edged.
It's interesting. I've been invited to several projects and I really appreciate it. I'm not one to turn down an invitation to something because opportunities are fantastic. They help us to grow as writers. And so some of the projects that I've been invited to have really forced me to stretch my comfort zone a whole lot. And so one of them was an invitation by Michael Bracken to his Chop Shop series. And so it was like a setting that I'm not familiar with. And it was a type of writing that I usually don't do. But I had such a good time just kind of getting into that project and writing about characters and writing about a place and writing about a type of crime that I didn't really know much about before. But I can probably tell you how to steal a Prius now. So ever wanted to do that.
You can teach your kids that.
Right, but exactly. Yes.
Is it something, anyway, and you can jump in here too, Joel. I mean, now I'm going to go back to the more conventional question for both of you. I mean, is it a different area of your brain when you're working on short fiction? And Joel, you know, it could be the, you know, these other genres, but I have a fun, let me digress at the Ballard thing. I was watching the movie version of Empire of the Sun. Mm. I was with, my mother was alive and I was over at my mother's house and my brother was over there, my younger brother. And he's, you know, he works for a hospital. He's a big shot and all this kind of stuff. And there's a scene where the Japanese are marching into Shanghai, and Christian Bale, as a little boy, I mean, he's a nutcase as a little boy, too, I guess.
Right, right.
He sees the plane, he lets go of his mother's hand. And my mother sits there and looks at both of us. She goes, I'm the oldest. She goes, you would not let go of my hand. Him, on the other hand, would let go of my hand.
Right.
And we wouldn't see him again till the war was over. And my brother's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, she's right. You would be like, oh, an airplane. You know, forget about this, the war that's going on. Do not let go of my hand. We are getting out of here. You know, so that's my Ballard story right there. But pardon the digression. But is it a different part of the brain? I mean, does everybody, you know, if you're a quote pantser, you have to be an outliner for that? Or is it all one big mishmash and skill is skill and art is art? I mean, what do you both say about that? You know, long versus short.
Really a different part of your brain, at least for me.
Okay.
I did write a novel length work, like just straight up traditional novel, not novel and stories, with the same characters. And I try to follow the same beats and use the same headspace that I used when I write like the shorter food-based stories. And I found really quickly that it was very hard to do. Like there was a point in time, like in the middle of the story, hit that saggy middle in the middle of the novel where I just felt like I was struggling. And it was because like I stopped and thought about it and I realized it's because I was trying to treat it the same way that I treated a short story. You can't use the same beats. There, you know, things have to happen a lot earlier in a novel, I would think, like, because you've got so many other things to introduce. You know, you can have a lot more characters in a novel just because there's so much space. And the themes don't have to be as condensed as they are in a short story. So once I kind of got out of that short story headspace, writing the novel was a lot easier for me. You know, with short stories, you write enough of them, you kind of know how much space you have to spread out. Like how deep can I go with a subplot? How early do I have to introduce these different aspects? With a novel, it felt a little intimidating to have that much space. I learned how to kind of rein it in. Okay. But yeah, it's totally different headspace for me. Joel, I don't know if you feel the same way.
You're going to totally disagree or, you know.
I mean, it is a different thing. And I haven't written any short fiction in, you know, probably 5 years or something. But my experience, I would say, is that it's almost like writing a short story could be like going into a dream, but you kind of submerge and you're in this one world and it's going to go on for a short period of time and then it's going to end and you come out of it. And so you're kind of casting a spell in a way to carry somebody through it, particularly in, science fiction type stuff. Whereas in a book and a novel, it's, you know, there's much more time for development of whether it's an alternative world or whether it's, you know, the world that we know, but you're populating it, you know, with the characters that you have. So I do feel it's very different. And I will say that I have struggled sometimes that a lot of things that I would write that were short did not have enough plot. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because I think I was used to a stretching out and a story evolving as opposed to, you know, having a very defined kind of space. And so it would be more of a slice of a character, which could be interesting. And some people write that way. But it's not what people think of as traditionally a short story that actually has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and, you know, like that. So I agree with that.
I really
feel like it's a different type of thing.
Well, I mean, is it genre related? I mean, you know, if you all who are listening to this, I mean, Ashley just nodded, but I mean, if you're say emulating somebody like William S. Burroughs, you know, yeah. which I think you do sometime. I think you were in your fiction or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you probably could get away with that. But if you're writing something for Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, I mean, they're going to want a plot. I mean, even if you're a total character person, like, you know, there's a reason why George Pelicanos, you know, writes novels, because he's a character guy. He's like, the characters are in there to drive the story. The story doesn't drive the characters, you know. But if you're writing a crime short story, they're going to want some semblance of a plot. But if it's your dream scenario, though, it's a little different.
I mean, I agree. I mean, things that I've written that were, you know, more literary, for lack of a better word, not science fiction, not crime, you know, they could tend to be a little more unstructured, if you will, sometimes, or at least not structured in the sense of a narrative arc. But certainly when I'm writing the book that I wrote, Wildwood Exit, and other things, you know, I'm working on a sequel to it right now. I mean, it's a story.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's protagonists and there's good guys and there's bad guys and there's people in between, you know, and a narrative arc that goes through it. So,
and again, this is for both of you. Do you think, and this goes back to what I was saying before, Ashley, about, you know, art versus business. Is there an invisible hand, not such thing, a visible hand in the market, but is there this invisible hand of publishers and agents and all those people saying you can't, you have to write a certain way because it has to be commercial and we have to meet the expectations of people and find them where they are, not try to uplift them to our, you know, what kind of art we want to do. I mean, you know, can you have dreamy stuff with the Skeletas, or, you know, or Ashley, can you get a little bit weirder with, you know, with Naomi? I mean, you know, is everything getting pushed towards the middle now? I mean, you know, that's my real question. I guess I was burying the lead for either of you. What's your feeling on that?
I don't know. I feel as though it's tricky because I've heard people say that, you know, everybody wants something different but familiar at the same time. And so it becomes hard, you know, to think about, well, how do I make myself stand out but also be familiar enough that, you know, people know where to place my book in the bookstore, or, you know, how do we find that happy middle? I don't think that art necessarily has to be sacrificed for, you know, general public tastes. I think that there are ways for us to meet expectations for the genre. I mean, because that's really what it boils down to. Like, when you pick up a mystery, you're expecting some kind of mysterious thing to happen. If you're picking up, you know, something literary, you know, there's a certain type of writing or a certain, you know, feeling that you expect to have when you read it. You know, there are a way to meet those expectations, but still, you know, inject your own special touch to it. And I hope that's what I try to do. Like, I try to stick very much in the, you know, Fair Play Clues. This is an amateur sleuth and, you know, it's culinary based. So there's definitely going to be food in it. But I definitely hope that when people read my work, they think about it a little differently. They say, okay, this is definitely Ashley's work. This is definitely, you know, her setting, her characters, the way they speak to each other, the kinds of situations that she puts them in. That's definitely her. You know, I don't think that the art has to be sacrificed per se. I just think that, you know, there are ways for us to meet those expectations that readers are looking for.
What about you, Joel? I mean, this is an interesting book. I mean, it's a non-mob book, and it has its own niche, But I mean, you know, are you trapped? You know, can you experiment with this a little more? I mean, are you doing that in the sequel? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that you can't fake it. I mean, I don't think a writer can fake it and be successful. I shouldn't say that because probably aren't people who fake it and are successful.
Yeah, there are.
But I won't mention them here, though. Yeah, but I think that if you're trying to, you know, put yourself in a pigeonhole that you shouldn't be in, why? I mean, unless you know you need the money or whatever, and God knows that's not. I'm not doing this for money. I mean, yeah, I'd love it if I got it, but so and I think that. One of the interesting things to me is just, for example, the, you know, Wildwood Exit has certainly a comedic aspect to it, you know, although it's a pretty dark story, essentially. But as I'm working on a sequel to it, and what I'm finding is, as it kind of follows John McGinty into the next chapter of his life, is that although maybe there's some comedy in it, like all the bad stuff that happened, it kind of comes home to roost. And so the book is actually, I think, going to be a little bit darker because, you know, he kind of got through, didn't, you know, without getting into the story, he didn't get in trouble with the law, but there was a lot of lying going on and that won't go away. And so I think that the story, you know, is going to, it has to be the story that it is, which is, I mean, sounds trivial, but
no,
you know, you can't try to jam a comedic aspect on it just because, you know, you'd like to do that. You know, if it comes, that's great. But, so I mean, you look at the Sopranos, I mean, look at all the directions that went. Wonderfully written, you know, series, all driven by the original idea, I think, that David Chase had, which was with the psychotherapist.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that really opened a whole avenue into this thing. You know, for him. So, I mean, a lot of it is just, you know, him and Junior and whatever, everybody doing mob stuff.
Right.
At the same time, you had a whole different angle on it that sometimes was funny, sometimes was really, you know, personally tragic. You know.
Well, and let me just now get into, we're not coming to the end, but I mean, I wanted to get to the climax here. The noir aspects, I mean, do you think, you know, this is for both of you, that the kind of moral ambiguity, the lack of a bright, shiny, happy ending, but more of an equilibrium kind of an ending, and then the stylized realism aspect, I mean, do you think that rather than shadows and dirty streets really define noir, or is it both, or, you know, cause I know it actually, I mean, you know, it just because you have a food based cozy and food based cozies have nice bright covers doesn't necessarily mean it's a nice, bright, neat little story and characters, you know, I mean, there is a little darkness there, and you know, likewise, you know, for Joel, I mean, you know, it's the you know, humor is all is often a mask for some really dark shit too. I mean, right. What do you guys think about that? I mean, are you stumbling kind of into a noir background, or is noir helping differentiate your novels? Let's say, let's just stick to the novels. You know, from say other people in you know, in your genres. Everybody's trying to think. That was a long question, but that's why we're on a podcast, to put you on the spot here. We're not here to, you know.
Oh, exactly.
You know, okay. You're hawking your new movie on Conan O'Brien's show. You know, but go ahead. Anybody, go ahead.
Did you want to go first, Joel? Or
no, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So, okay. So I struggle with this a lot because, you know, every time I tell somebody I write crime fiction, they say, oh my goodness, you write crime fiction, but you're so bubbly.
Right.
And I, you know, when I think about it, one thing that I do try to include in my books or in my stories is like a moment of joy. Like I am actually like really big on that. Part of it is because most of my characters are Black, and there is a lot of, unfortunately, like when we read things, there's a lot of like trauma that's visited upon Black characters. And I wanted to show like the joyful aspect of that. But the fact of the matter is that murder, sexual assault,
greed,
you know, just general like wrath and anger and really poor decisions are things that happen, and they cause crimes. And those are all present in this book. And my characters have to deal with them realistically. I feel like that aspect of it kind of contributes to that noir, that noir feeling, because it is the darkness. You know, those things do happen. And I know there are some cozies that try to kind of treat them glibly, but I try not to do that because they are serious topics. Like they are, you know, real things that people have to deal with. I guess for me, although I am okay with including those aspects, I do try to balance them out with that joy, because that is really why I write about crime. It's to show that, you know, bad things happen in communities, but when we come together, we can
right.
kind of move things forward, like when we're very committed to that. And so I don't know if that takes my work squarely out of the noir category, because it doesn't.
Yeah, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I mean, it depends,
But I, you know, trying to deal with things realistically, like not shying away from those things, you know, those are the aspect of my work that I think mostly relates to that title of noir. But, you know, it's interesting to think about, because it is such a, you know, widely encompassing spectrum that,
right.
you know, crime fiction can fall on.
Right. I mean, it's an edge. I mean, an edge is going to set you apart, you know, regardless. Yeah. Well, what about you, Joel? I mean, you know, I keep coming back to the humor and the kind of, you know, there's the white collar, you know, Don Corleone stuff. And then there's the real kind of blue collar, right. everyday Joe stuff going on there. I mean, is that going to generate some noir right there? Because you've got people who are just, their lives, period, have an edge to them, often without them making any choices. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I did think about a little bit about, I wasn't thinking when I wrote the book, oh, this is going to be a noir novel. But it was just a story, and I was going
right.
to tell the story. As I thought about what noir is, I mean, is it Double Indemnity? You know, Barbara Stanwyck,
yeah.
and Fred McMurray, right? Which is, you know, a pretty dark story. Is it Dashiell Hammett? Red Harvest, which is just brutal. Is it Raymond Chandler, which has an artistic? I mean, I think that's more of the George Palikanos.
Right.
It's very stylized
yeah.
kind of writing around it. Or even in the movies, is something like Fargo. Is that
right.
noir?
Right.
Right. Or as somebody said, it's actually Blanc, right? Because it's white.
Yeah. Right.
But to me, the reason why I have publicized it, you will, or use that tag phrase, is that it's not a procedural. You don't have a
right.
detective. You have a protagonist who's compromised in his situation. Who is his allegiance to? He's done some illegal things, and a bit of a, you know, there's a moral dilemma which he faces, and the other characters face in dealing essentially with family things. You know, with how are you going to treat your son as an addict? You know, you're going to cast him out, or you're going to try to bail him out, and then what if he takes advantage of you? You know, all that type of stuff. So to me, it really was the fact that there's a crime aspect to it, but it's sort of low level, and you're dealing with a lot of kind of compromised individuals.
Yeah.
And that to me was sort of how I thought of it as being a noir tale.
Yeah, I mean, and that fits into the definition too. Compromised individuals, you know. And I'm glad you brought up Fargo too, because that there's an example of stuff that's humorous, but has that edge, has that darkness. But right. People are kind of fumbling around. I mean, you kind of like, who are these idiots?
That's
this
right.
Movie could be 10 minutes long if people just act normal.
Right. You know. Right. Right.
You know, I mean, and let me get back to you, Ashley, real quick. Do you think that is something that you're going to see more of in Cozies, more of an edge where people are kind of fumbling around, and
yeah.
if they just stop messing around, stop fucking around, everything would be fine.
I feel as though Cozies are becoming a little edgier. You know, it's interesting because there are some people that like their cozies like squeaky clean, like they like, you know, no cursing, no, like
right.
nobody has sex, nobody like says right. a bad word. And it's very unrealistic to me when you're writing for adults. So I feel as though people are, you know, people want lighter stories that feel a little bit more realistic, where, you know, where these characters are speaking and acting the way that normal adult characters.
Okay. Well, all right. Now I'm going to ask you the $64,000 question here.
Let's hear
it. Do you think that female writers of color in Cozies have been the ones pushing that envelope?
I feel like we definitely are on the forefront of that, just because there are certain issues that women of color deal with on a regular basis. They can't just be ignored. A lot of people like to think of Cozies as like escapist.
I'm talking in a narrow food Cozies too, pushing that envelope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So they think about it as like a way to escape anything that's negative, or a way to escape anything that's, and again, then that's when the murders get treated really glibly. But I think that when women of color are writing, you know, we're coming from that intersectionality of being women and being people of color. And generally we're writing about characters that kind of experience things in a different way. Like, there are issues that we can't ignore, that we can't walk away from. And so our characters generally can't either. And so just, you know, bringing certain ideas to the forefront. My character deals with colorism. She deals with, like, you know, again, there's like some sexual assault
right.
issue themes in the book. So like there are things that my character as a woman of color has to deal with, and things that she can't just ignore. So yeah, I do think that a lot of women, a lot of people of color are kind of pushing things into the edgier.
You still have the kind of cartoony covers, though.
I know. I love my cover, though. I absolutely love it.
Raquel and Mia, you know, it's like...
But yeah, no. I know exactly what you mean. They
like
feel
Bluey,
like a lot of fun.
You know, on TV. let me kind of... I'm not going to give you the last word, Joel, but I want to close out with you on the discussions. I mean, have you ever thought about... in another work, marrying South Philly with North Philly. You know, Ashley was talking about people of color. I mean, do you ever think about that kind of interesting dichotomy and kind of bringing that together in a humorous way, or maybe not in a humorous way?
That's a really pretty interesting idea. I have not, although the work that I'm working on now, the book I'm working on now, which is a sequel to it, actually involves a Cambodian and Vietnamese community in Philadelphia.
Right. Okay.
And it has to do with human trafficking and money laundering, so it gets kind of heavy.
Right.
But the North Philly angle would be an interesting one. sort of a Chester Hines. Do you know Chester? Like Chester
yeah,
Hines.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Right?
You know?
Because I'm just trying, you know, everybody talks about each city and the peculiarities, and
yeah.
I don't, why hasn't and unless I'm drawing a total old man blank here, why hasn't Philadelphia created its Pelicanos, or are you its Pelicanos now?
I don't think so.
Do we have to give it that title to you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. What I would say is that in the film or video end, Mayor of Easttown,
right,
and
I was going to add, yeah, I was going to.
That's all done by Brad Inglesby, who's a Philly guy.
Right.
Enough of your basketball guy, but
yeah,
his dad was Tommy Inglesby, who was a big time high school and college basketball player.
Yeah.
But Brad Inglesby is basically from the same milieu that I'm from.
You go to St. Joseph's University? Is that
Inglesby went to Villanova.
Villanova, okay. It was going to be one of those. Right?
That's a whole thing. That's the same.
Yeah, I mean, we're coming almost to the end, but I mean, that's an interesting point you made. I should have brought that up. Is that the hallmark now? Is now culturally, you've got like the food cozies, and you've got the more ethnic food cozies that are pushing the end. And then in Philly, it's not the Pelicano stuff, or your version of The Wire is basically Mayor of Easton and
right.
Task. And it's,
right.
it must be kind of, it's like poor white people in trouble again is the Philly hallmark. Because it's kind of ironic, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, years ago, I don't know if you know David Fulmer, he wrote a book called The Blue Door.
Right.
And that was set in Philadelphia. David Fulmer's a great writer. And that was what you might have thought of as South Philly, a crime family story.
Yeah,
he's not really doing that kind of stuff right now, but he certainly did that. And there probably are other Philly writers that I'm not thinking of or don't know who are operating in that genre.
It's the pounding the streets kind of thing. I'm drawing a blank, but Mayor of Easton and Task. You know, the stuff going, out the kind of adjacent county stuff with meth or something like that, or just some murder.
Yeah, I think that if you think about Mayor of Easttown and Task, both of them could be related to something like Winter's Bone.
Yeah.
Rural in a way.
Yeah, I did it. Yeah.
In Philly, a lot of the motorcycle gangs and stuff have always operated, out in the country where they could do the business a little more. It's one thing to run away from the Philly cops. It's another thing to run away from the Coatesville cops.
Or Delaware County,
Havertown. Havertown police are not, doing that.
So let me, we're wrapping up. I'm just really absolutely thrilled talking to you guys, because again, I wanted to show, you guys aren't emerging voices. You're not neophytes, but you're also, people that other people need to take note of. And I wanted to give you that platform, because this type of work is really fantastic. And I think we showed in this hour there are common threads. I think we can show, without relying on ChatGPT, that this is kind of noir. There's noir threads.
Right.
So we answered that question. I just want to thank you guys for coming on. Any last words before we sign off and say, you can look at Chris Chambers Noir and iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Incandescent Radio Network. Anything you want to add to that, or is it a general bye-bye, or you guys have the last word?
I just want to say thanks to you, Chris, for inviting us. I think everything that you're doing to really just continue to create a literary community, like in your local area, but also just, nationwide for all of us, it doesn't go unnoticed. And so thank you for everything that you're doing and for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Chris, I would say the same thing. It's really, what you're doing is great. Lorette, seen a lot of the other interviews and really enjoyed them a lot. And I've enjoyed the conversation a lot. Ashley, it was great to get to know you a little bit about your work. I would say one thing is that we didn't talk at all about food.
Well, my book has
a restaurant setting.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm going to tell you straight up. I mean, that's on purpose because anybody can ask you guys that. Anybody can ask you about, right. you know, where, you know, what's the frou-frou food in Cape May versus the scallopini in
right,
Wildwood.
Right, right, right.
And anybody can ask her about, you know, just, right. you know, I need some rice and peas. Yeah.
Right, right.
Well, thank you guys. This has been great. And, you know, definitely look for Ashley's book. Ashley, wave it around. You know, the Bush Tea Murder and Joel E. Turner, Wildwood Exit. And both of them have a body of short fiction, too. Definitely go out and buy the book. And you can get the links, you know, on Incandescent, right. The radio link, and my podcast link as well. So thank you guys. Happy Friday the 13th.
Ides of March.
My son's middle school event. So yeah, Friday the 13th.
Yeah, there you go.
Good. I think it's perfect for this topic, right? Thank you all. This is wonderful. As Chris said, all the liner notes with the links to buy your books and learn more about them and to your websites are on incandescentradio.com. And you'll find it on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple. And of course, Chris Chambers Noir TV is his YouTube channel. So ChrisChambersNoir.com. Join us. Joel, Ashley, this has been fantastic. We look forward to promoting you more and sharing your wisdom and your work. So thank you all.
Thanks very much.
13th.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take everybody, care. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you soon.